but Nagel kept saying that the mass on his bottom finder looked to be at 230 feet. Worse, it seemed to rise only about 30 feet off the sand. Chatterton was capable of diving to 230 feet. He and Nagel devised a plan. Brennan and Hildeman would throw the hook. Chatterton would splash and check out whatever was on the bottom. If it looked worth diving, and the depth was reasonable, he would tie in the anchor line. If it was some crappy barge or pile of rocks, or if the depth really was 260 feet, he would trip loose the hook, return to the surface, and call off the dive. Nagel agreed. By now the other divers had gathered on the deck below the wheelhouse, awaiting a verdict. Nagel slid the door open, stepped out, and leaned over the rail. "Listen, ladies, this is what I see. Whatever is down there is at 220, 230 feet, and it's laying low. This is Doria diving, maybe tougher. John's going to splash first and check it out. If it's some crap garbage barge, we don't touch it. This shit is too deep to be diving a barge. If it's something decent and it's not eat you alive deep, we go. Either way, we wait for John. Nobody goes until John gives the okay." Chatterton collected his gear from the rear deck and began to suit up while Nagel attempted to hook the wreck. When the anchor caught, Nagel cut the boat's engines. The seeker and the mass at the ocean's bottom were now connected. Nagel climbed down to the back deck, where Chatterton was making a final check of his gauges. Before long, everyone on the boat had gathered around the dressing table. Chatterton gave some final instructions. "Give me 6 minutes, then give me slack," he told Nagel. "That'll give me time to shoot down and look around. If the thing is no good or too deep, I'm going to pop 2 cups. If you see 2 cups, that means I'm not tying in, and you should take up the grapple and I'll come up with it. But if I send up 1 cup, that means it's worth diving and it's not too deep. You see 1 cup, take in the slack, because I'm already tied in." Chatterton turned to the rest of the divers. "Just to be safe, just to make sure there's no problem, nobody splashes until I finish my deco and come back on board and brief you guys. Everyone cool with that?" The divers nodded. Chatterton walked to the edge of the boat, placed his regulator in his mouth, pulled his mask over his face, and checked his watch. 6 minutes. Nagel checked his watch. 6 minutes. Nagel went back to the wheelhouse, killed the power on the Loran units, and hid the bottom finder's thermal paper graphs in a drawer. He liked these guys. They were his customers and his friends. But he didn't risk his numbers with anyone. Yerga, Brennan, and Hildeman returned to the bow. Chatterton knelt on the rail and fell sideways into the ocean. Chatterton swam just below the surface to the anchor line, then grabbed hold of the line and purged a bit of air from his wings to reduce his buoyancy. The current began swirling and ripping, and not just in one direction, so that the anchor line bent in S-shapes, and Chatterton found himself white-knuckling the line and forcing himself down two-handed in a fight to keep from being blown from the rope. In normal seas, such a descent might have taken 2 minutes. 5 minutes after he splashed, Chatterton was still fighting. "I'm getting my ass kicked, and they're going to give me slack before I even get down there," he mumbled to himself. As his watch clicked 6 minutes, he landed on a mass of metal near the sand. White particulate matter flew horizontally past his eyes in the swirling, dark green water. A sideways white Christmas in September. In the poor 5-foot visibility, he could see only specks of rust on the metal, and above him, a rounded railing and a soft corner of some kind. An oddly streamlined shape, he thought, for what was probably just a barge. But at least this wasn't a pile of rocks. Chatterton checked his depth gauge. 218 feet. The sand below him looked to be 230 feet, the outer limit diveable by the men topside. He scanned for a high point to tie into, and noticed what looked to be a strut at about 210 feet. The slack arrived, lucky to reach him through the swirling waters above. Chatterton tripped loose the grapple, swam to the strut, and tied the grapple and its 15 feet of chain until the hook was secure. He took one white foam cup from his goodie bag and released it. This dive was a go. Aboard the Seeker, the crew at the bow scanned the waves. When Chatterton's signal appeared, Yerga ran to the galley and threw open the door. "He blew one cup," Yerga yelled. "We're going diving." The crew hauled in the anchor line's slack, wrapped it snug to the bit, and joined the rest of the divers on the Seeker's back deck. Chatterton would likely spend 20 minutes on the bottom, meaning he would owe an hour of decompression. No one made a move for his equipment. Everyone waited for Chatterton. At the ocean's bottom, Chatterton clipped a strobe light to the anchor line's chain. Sideways white particles continued to rush through the green-black ocean panorama, limiting Chatterton's visibility to no more than 10 feet. In his headlight beam, Chatterton could make out the general shape of a ship's hull. But this hull seemed to him to have a soft roll to it, an elegant shape built not for moving cargo or pumping supplies, but for gliding. At 205 feet, he reached the top of the wreck and began to pull himself forward against the current, careful to keep hold of the structure underneath to avoid being blown adrift. With every foot he moved forward, a new snapshot emerged under the interrogation of his headlight, leaving the previous scene fading to black. In this way, Chatterton's progress over the mass was more slideshow than movie. He moved slowly to digest every picture. Much of the mass lay covered in white and orange anemones, dulling the shape of whatever lay beneath. A few seconds later, Chatterton pulled himself to an area overgrown in bent and rusted pipes, a tangle of chopped and frayed electric cables, a sudden haircut around it. Beneath this nest of broken equipment, bolted to the wreck, lay four undamaged cylinders, each perhaps 6 feet in length. "Those are pipes," Chatterton thought. "This is a pipe barge. Damn, this is probably a tanker or sludge barge." Chatterton continued along the top of the wreck. Narcosis began to hum as Muzak from the background of his brain. A few seconds later, he spotted a hatch. He stopped. Barges did not have hatches like this. He swam closer. The hatch was angled into the mass. Hatches are not supposed to be built at angles. They are meant to allow people and things to enter ships, so they are supposed to open straight down. Who would build a hatch that angled into a ship? Chatterton pushed his head inside the hatch. The interior of the mass lit white under his headlight. This was a room. He was sure because the walls were still there. A startled fish with a wide face and fang whiskers swam past Chatterton's mask, looked him briefly in the eye, then U-turned and disappeared back into the wreck. Visibility was excellent in this enclosed space, protected from ocean particulates. Against one of the walls lay a shape. Chatterton stayed motionless and took it in. "This shape," he thought, "is unlike any other shape in the world." Chatterton's heart pounded. Was he seeing things? Was he more narked than he believed? He closed his eyes for a moment and opened them again. The shape was still there. Fins, propeller, cigar body, a shape from scary books and terrifying movies, a shape left over from childhood's imagination, a shape of power, a torpedo, a complete, intact torpedo. Chatterton's body heaved. He began a two-man dialogue with himself, partly to check his narcosis, partly because this was too much to discuss alone. "I'm narked," he told himself. I'm at 220 feet. I'm exhausted from fighting the current. I could be seeing things.
You are on top of a submarine, he replied.
There are no submarines anywhere near this part of the ocean. I have books. I have studied books. There are no submarines here. This is impossible.
You are on top of a submarine.
I'm narked.
There is no other shape like that torpedo. Remember those rolled edges you saw on the hull? The ones that looked built for gliding? Submarine. You have just discovered a submarine.
This is a huge dive.
No, John, this is more than a huge dive. This is the Holy Grail.
Chatterton pulled his head outside the hatch. A minute ago he'd had no idea where he was on this wreck. Now the torpedo had become a lighthouse. He knew that submarines fired torpedoes from both ends. That meant he was near either the bow or the stern. The current moved in the direction the torpedo pointed. If he let go and drifted with the current, he would soon arrive at one end of the wreck. At that point it would be simple to determine whether it was bow or stern. As he released his grip, the current awoke and roared so suddenly that it seemed to have been screamed from the submarine itself. An angry exhaust from a long-asleep machine now awakened. The current flung Chatterton past the anchor line, slingshotting him toward the end of the wreck. In another second he would be blown into the abyss. Instinctively he thrust out a glove. Something solid hit his hand. Chatterton caught hold of a bent piece of metal at the tip of the wreck. Beyond that metal, there was only ocean and sand. He breathed deeply and steadied himself. The end of the wreck was before him. Chatterton had seen photographs of submarines before. The bows were blunted and angled downward and aft, while the sterns were streamlined horizontally at the top, to make room for propellers and rudder underneath. This was the bow. This was the bow of a submarine. He looked closely at the marine growth and the deterioration of the metal on the wreck. There was no mistaking the ship's vintage. This submarine had come from World War II. He knew from his books that there were no sunken American submarines in this area. He looked again at the wreck. For a moment he dared not think it. But it was undeniable. "I'm holding on to a U-boat," Chatterton said out loud. "I'm holding on to a World War II German U-boat." By now Chatterton had reached the end of his 20-minute bottom time. He swam back to the strobe light he had clipped to the anchor line, staying close to the wreck to shield himself from the wrath of the onrushing current. As he swam, he watched the hull's rolled edges unfold below him. Beautiful curves engineered for stealth. Curves that still looked secret. It was time for Chatterton to leave. His first scheduled decompression stop was not until a depth of 60 feet. On the way up, his narcosis fading, he argued against himself. Maybe you didn't see a torpedo. Maybe you saw a fan inside a pipe barge. People come up from 230 feet saying stupid things all the time. And now you're going to be the guy saying the stupid stuff. He knew better. He controlled his narcosis. That was a torpedo. That was the bow of a U-boat. Chatterton made his first stop at 60 feet. The water was sunlit and warm. The last traces of narcosis had evaporated. The torpedo's image now throbbed sharp in his memory. The catalogue of submarines he had studied over the years emerged as a dossier before him. Some were hundreds of miles to the north, others hundreds of miles south. None was anywhere near here. Could there be a crew on board? Could this be a U-boat with a crew on board that no one in the world knew about but him? Too fantastic.
And what was it doing in New Jersey waters? Chatterton ascended to 40 feet and began his second hang. There he remembered a dream he'd had years ago of finding a mystery submarine. In that dream, the sub he discovered was Russian, and the crew still on board. It was a glorious dream, but the part he remembered most was how immediately he realized it had been a dream. And he had realized this within a second of awakening, because such a wonderful thing could never happen in real life. Chatterton ascended to 30 feet and began another stop. He had another 25 minutes decompression time before he could surface and brief the others about his find. Topside, the divers followed Chatterton's bubbles as they gurgled to the surface along the anchor line. They were supposed to wait for him to surface. "The suspense is killing me," Brennan told the other divers. "I gotta do something." Brennan, with his long hair, Fu Manchu mustache, and "it's cool, dude" sensibility, might have passed for a Grateful Dead roadie if he hadn't been such a meticulous diver. While every other man aboard the Seeker that day favored a modern dry suit that provided deep insulation from the 40-degree Atlantic bottom temperatures, Brennan stayed loyal to the tattered, epoxied, and patched wetsuit he wore to retrieve sunken golf carts and fix swimming pools in rich folks' backyards. Bound by duty, other divers would break Brennan's stones about his ancient get-up. "Kevin," they'd ask, "does that suit date to the Neolithic or the Mesozoic era?" "You guys want to be all toasty and warm," Brennan would counter. "I wear this same suit to the Doria, man. The Doria. I have more mobility in this thing than all you guys put together. And goddammit, if I gotta piss, I piss. You mooks in your dry suits have to hold it in. Fuck that crap. I piss." Other divers would hear this explanation and shake their heads. It was 40 degrees on the Doria. A wetsuit was like wearing a T-shirt. But damn if Brennan didn't surface after 90 minutes in those temperatures, clutching some killer artifact or fat lobster. Grinning ear to ear as he stepped out of his patchwork wetsuit, dive after successful dive, he seemed to have a bit of Houdini in him. As Chatterton's bubbles continued to rise along the anchor line, Brennan geared up in his trademark minimalist fashion. He didn't believe in draping himself in backup gear and the latest accoutrements. Those guys looked like goddamn Christmas trees. To Brennan, the less you carried, the less that could go wrong, and the faster you could splash in case you couldn't stand the suspense any longer. Within minutes, Brennan had flipped over the Seeker's side. Seconds later, he reached Chatterton, who was still hanging, still shoehorning the wonder of his discovery into the reality centers of his brain. Brennan startled him with a tap on the shoulder, then put his palms up and shrugged his shoulders, the universal "what's up" signal. Chatterton removed a writing slate and pencil from his goodie bag, then scrawled a single word as big and bold as would fit on the tablet. It said, "Sub." For a moment, Brennan could not move. Then he began to scream through his regulator. The words came out as if spoken from behind two pillows, but were still intelligible. "Are you kidding, John? Are you sure? Really?" Chatterton nodded. Brennan yelled, "Oh, God! Oh, shit! Oh, Christ!" Brennan could have plunged straight down to the wreck and had the submarine to himself. But this was not the kind of information decent dudes hoarded. He shot back up the anchor line, bobbed on the surface, and yanked the regulator from his mouth. "Yo, Bill! Bill!" he called to Nagel, who was still in the wheelhouse. Nagel rushed outside the compartment, thinking Brennan was in trouble. A diver wouldn't surface and scream after a minute underwater unless he was in trouble. "What the hell happened, Kevin?" Nagel called. "Yo, Bill! Bill! Check this out! John says it's a submarine!" Nagel did not need to hear anything else. He ran down the wheelhouse stairs and gathered the remaining divers. "Chatterton says it's a sub." Until this point, many of the divers had held deep reservations about exploring a new wreck at 230 feet. The word sub vaporized those concerns. The divers rushed to gear up. Only Nagel, whose alcoholism had degraded his physical condition and had made this kind of deep diving impossible, remained behind. On the anchor line, Brennan stuffed the regulator back into his mouth and headed down, pumping a pair of way-to-go fists as he passed Chatterton. Several minutes later, as Chatterton ascended to his 20-foot stop, the other 11 divers dropped past him on an express parade to the Virgin wreck. Chatterton hadn't had his chance to brief the men on the wreck's danger or depth, but he would have had to lie about the submarine to prevent any of them from diving that day, and Chatterton didn't lie. The wreck lay at 230 feet at its bottommost point in the sand, about 210 feet at the top, the outer range of doable for a dozen men dizzy with possibility. When Chatterton finally finished decompressing, he swam underneath the seeker and climbed the aluminum ladder at its stern. Nagel waited for his protégé, hanging on the back rail until Chatterton could remove his mask and sit on the dressing table. Jim Beam had chipped away at Nagel's muscles and reflexes, and had begun to turn his skin yellow. But it hadn't touched his explorer's heart, the part of him that believed an alcoholic world still to be beautiful for the stories it hid in secret places. He ambled over to Chatterton, shaded his eyes from the sun, and nodded to his friend. He wanted to say something momentous because this was the day men like he and Chatterton dreamed of. Instead, the two men simply looked at each other.
"I hear we did good," Nagel finally said.
"Yeah, Bill," Chatterton said, clapping his friend on the shoulder. "We did good."
For a minute, Nagel could only shake his head and say, "Damn." Every fiber in his failing body leaned toward the ocean in the way plants bend toward the sun. He had never so desperately desired to splash as he did at this moment. He had long since stopped bringing gear. But as he gazed at Chatterton, his mind was already in the water.
"Tell me about it, John," Nagel said. "Tell me everything. Tell me every detail, every bit of what you saw and felt and heard."
Until this point, Chatterton had never been able to tell Nagel anything new. Whatever groundbreaking work Chatterton had done on the Doria and other great wrecks, Nagel had been there first, and this had pushed Chatterton to explore harder and deeper, to go some day where even the great Bill Nagel hadn't gone. That day, Chatterton could see in Nagel's grade-school big eyes had come. He told Nagel everything. As he finished his narrative, Chatterton expected Nagel to ask technical questions, to grill him on the wreck's level of metallic degradation or the silt buildup inside the torpedo hatch. Instead, Nagel said,
"This submarine can change me. This can motivate me and get my health back. This is the thing that can get me back."
As Nagel helped Chatterton undress, the other divers began their exploration of the wreck 230 feet below. The current had eased since Chatterton had departed, allowing those so inclined to swim along the hull without fear of exhaustion. Ostrowski and Roberts studied the outline of the wreck and the flatness of its topside decking. Both pegged it for a submarine. The duo swam slowly along the top of the wreck, careful not to overbreathe in their excitement, never knowing whether they moved forward or aft. They soon reached a hole in the top of the steel hull that looked to have been blown violently inward. Steel didn't bend like that willingly. They stuck their heads inside, and their lights brought to life a zoo of broken pipes, machinery, valves, and switches. They craned their necks upward and lit nests of electric cables dangling from the ceiling. Their breath quickened. This room could contain history. A quick swim in and a quick swim out, and they might find the wreck's identity. Neither dared enter. This room might contain answers, but it also held 100 ways to kill the overeager diver. Shu and Cochrane took in the wreck's cigar shape and considered its level of deterioration. Each had experience diving World War II ships, and this wreck looked to them to be worn in just the same ways. The team spent most of its dive working to loosen a valve that interested Cochrane, but the part would not budge. Hildeman, diving alone, had a tougher time believing that the mass he stood on was a submarine. That changed as he arrived near the bow of the wreck about 10 feet off the sand, where he saw a long, narrow tube reaching into the boat. He had read books on submarines before. This was a torpedo tube, the weapon's passageway into the ocean. Skibinski and Feldman ventured 40 feet from the wreck to obtain a wider view, a bold decision at this depth and visibility. They looked at each other and nodded. A submarine. They swam back toward the strobe they had clipped to the anchor line. Both men had dived the Texas Tower, one of the darkest of the Northeast's deep wrecks. This wreck was darker. They stayed close to the strobe. McMahon and Yerga remained atop the wreck. They, too, knew that this streamlined form belonged to a submarine. As they drifted higher, Yerga spotted flooding vents along the hull, the centerpiece of a submarine's diving system. A minute later, Yerga beheld the angled hatch that Chatterton had seen. He, too, pushed his head and light inside. He, too, saw the tail fins and propeller of the most notorious sea weapon ever built. The men yearned to see more, but each had agreed topside that at this depth their first priority would be to stay near the anchor line and therefore stay alive. Yerga grabbed a lobster and joined McMahon on the ascent back to the dive boat. Brennan, the first to arrive after Chatterton, inched forward in the current until he came to what he recognized was the bow of the sub. He allowed himself to drift farther forward until he was 20 feet in front of the wreck, then turned around to face the bow. He bled a wisp of air from his wings and sank gently to the sand, landing on his knees. He knelt there as a worshipper, reverent before this grand, unmistakable mass. The current began to howl, but Brennan stayed rooted in the sand, transfixed. "I can't believe this," he thought. "I know this is a U-boat. I know this thing is German. Look at it. It's coming right at me, like in the opening scene in Das Boot. I can hear the music from the movie." From behind his wonder and narcosis, an inner voice managed to remind Brennan about the current. He swam back, fighting the water every kick of the way until he reached the anchor line, deeply narked, winded, and light-headed. "I'll never let go of that wreck again," he promised himself. Then he began his ascent back to the Seeker. Between 1939 and 1945, Germany assembled a force of 1,167 U-boats. Each one, for its ability to stalk enemies invisibly, became the most perfect and terrible reflection of man's first fear, that death lurks silently and everywhere, always. Some U-boats crept with impunity to within a few miles of American shores, close enough to tune in jazz radio stations and watch automobile headlights through their periscopes. In 1 month in 1940, U-boats sank 66 ships while losing only one of their own. Bodies of men killed aboard ships sunk by U-boats washed up on American shores during World War II. The sight was gruesome. The implication, that the killers could be anywhere but could not be seen or heard, was magnitudes worse. Of those 1,167 U-boats, 757 were either sunk, captured, bombed in home ports or foreign bases, or fell from accident or collision. Of the 859 U-boats that left base for frontline patrol, 648 were sunk or captured while operating at sea, a loss rate of more than 75%. Some were sunk by enemy vessels and aircraft that could not confirm the kills, others by mines, still others by mechanical or human failure. Because most U-boats died beneath the water's surface, as many as 65 disappeared without explanation. In worlds of unsearchable water, U-boats made the perfect, unfindable graves. This day, as the divers began to surface and board the Seeker, they rushed out of their gear and into the bait. Each of them was giddy to have discovered a virgin submarine. Each of them already had a theory. It could be U-550, a U-boat supposedly sunk in the far North Atlantic but never recovered. It could not be the American S-5. Numerous divers had searched for and researched that sub for years and were certain it lay near Maryland. The crew could have escaped. A hatch looked to be open, though it was hard to tell. Something violent might have happened to the submarine. No one had seen the conning tower, the distinctively shaped observation post and entryway atop submarines that houses the periscopes and serves as the commander's battle station. A refrain began to build. Where the hell was the conning tower? Then Yerga. He had stopped, by chance, at a naval bookstore the day before to pick up some light reading for the trip. His choice? The U-boat, the evolution and technical history of German submarines. When he produced the book after surfacing, the divers crowded over his shoulder to compare their memories to the book's detailed schematic diagrams. Chatterton recognized the cylindrical bottles he had seen on the wreck. Yerga saw the flooding vents. This thing had to be German. This thing had to be a U-boat. As the divers continued their discussion and book study, Chatterton and Nagel drifted from the group and climbed into the wheelhouse. The crew pulled the anchor. Nagel set a course back for Brielle, fired the diesels, and pulled away from the site. Then he and Chatterton began a private discussion. This was a historic dive, they agreed. But discovery was only half the job. The other half, the everything half, lay in identification. Both men scoffed at divers who guessed at the identity of wrecks they had found, who didn't understand the slovenliness of saying, "Well, we found a piece of china with a Danish stamp, therefore the wreck is Danish." Were Nagel and Chatterton simply to announce that they had found a submarine? What would that really tell anyone? But to announce with certainty the identity of the submarine you discovered, to give the nameless a name, that is when a man writes history. To Nagel, there were also more worldly reasons for making the identification. Even in his broken-down physical state, the captain retained his appetite for glory. Identifying this submarine would guarantee his legacy as a dive legend and extend his reputation to the outside world. A place that didn't know from the USS San Diego or even the Andrea Doria, but always paid attention to the word U-boat. A find like this would make him famous. A positive identification would mean customers. In those rare instances when a dive charter captain discovered a shipwreck, he came to own that wreck in the minds of divers. They wanted to travel with the guy who'd found the missing, to attach themselves to history through the man who had looked inside it. Nagel and Chatterton believed it would take just another dive or two to pull a positive piece of identification from the wreck. A tag, a builder's plaque, a diary, something. Until then, there was sound reason not to utter a word of the discovery to anyone. A virgin sub, especially if it were a U-boat, would attract the attention of rival divers everywhere. Some might attempt to shadow the Seeker on its next trip in order to pick off the location. Others might guess at the general vicinity of the location, then try to sneak up on the Seeker while she was anchored with divers in the water, unable to cut away and run. Once a rival had the numbers, he could rush in and steal the Seeker's credit and glory. there would be no shortage of pirates looking to make their bones on such a once-in-a-lifetime discovery. But in the minds of Chatterton and Nagel, the gravest threat came from a single source, and neither man had to invoke the name to know against whom they had to guard this wreck with their lives. Belinda. In 1991, the eastern seaboard featured only a handful of big-name dive charter boats. The Seeker was one of them. Another was the Long Island-based Wahoo, a 55-foot fiberglass hull captained by 55-year-old Steve Belinda, a barrel-chested, cherubic-faced man who looked to be accordioned under his 215-pound frame. A 1980 Newsday feature had dubbed Belinda King of the Deep, and he seemed unwilling to allow a day to pass without reminding those who would listen, and especially those who would not, of the coronation. From the moment Nagel entered the charter business, in the mid-1980s, he and Belinda despised each other. No one, including the captains themselves, seemed certain how the hard feelings started. But for years they lobbed accusations at each other, verbal grenades filled with reputation-piercing shrapnel. Nagel was a drunk has-been who endangered his divers and berated customers. Belinda was a do-nothing blowhard who was just following the money, going with the established wrecks, doing nothing new. Customers often found themselves forced to choose sides. A diver became either Stevie's boy or Billy's boy, and pity the soul who confessed to diving with both. "You're diving the Wahoo next week?" an incredulous Nagel would ask customers. "What kind of fucking guy are you? He'll break your balls and steal your money. You're cattle to him." It was equally unpretty on the Wahoo, where the crew would join Belinda in a dressing down of anyone foolish enough to admit enjoying the Seeker. "Hose this guy off," Wahoo crewmen were heard to say loudly of paying customers. "He stinks like the Seeker." After one Wahoo customer admitted to a fondness for Nagel, he found the hardcover book he had brought along at the bottom of the boat's bilge. By 1991, the Belinda-Nagel feud had become notorious. To Nagel's supporters, the foundation of Belinda's bitterness was basic. Nagel was a threat to Belinda's title. Nagel drank too much, sure, but he remained an explorer, an original thinker, a researcher, a dreamer, a man of daring. And he was, as his growing customer base noted, a bit of a diving legend. To many, Belinda seemed to do little of what made Nagel great, little of the pioneering that should have been protein to a true king of the deep. Next to Nagel, Belinda appeared to play it safe, a guy who would always sit out bad weather at the dock while Nagel challenged angry seas. As Nagel's reputation for exploration grew, customers drifted to his boat. Belinda's business could easily withstand the migration. What he seemed unable to tolerate was the affront to his throne. It wasn't Belinda's words, however, that worried Nagel as the Seeker bobbed above this mystery submarine. It was his certainty that Belinda would stop at nothing to claim jump the wreck. He had heard stories about Belinda, that if you crewed for him on the Wahoo, you might be expected to give him a choice of whatever artifacts you recovered. That he half-jokingly told customers that should they ever recover the Oregon's bell while diving from the Wahoo, they had better be prepared to gift it to the King of the Deep or swim 13 miles back to shore with the artifact. That Belinda had friends, and they seemed to be everywhere, in the Coast Guard, on other charters, on fishing boats, in the Eastern Dive Boat Association, of which he was president. Nagel was convinced that if word leaked of the U-boat discovery, Belinda would head straight for it, and his goals would be threefold and deadly. Identify the wreck, raid the artifacts, take the credit. Chatterton figured that even if the Wahoo didn't jump the wreck, other divers looking to make their bones would try. Secrecy, therefore, would have to be paramount.
The Seeker is booked for the next 2 weeks, Nagel told Chatterton. Let's come back on the 21st, a Saturday. We invite only the guys on this trip, no one else. Not a goddamn other person. Because these guys took a shot and that'll be their reward. We make a pact. Nobody on the boat breathes a word to anyone. This is our submarine. I'm with you, Chatterton said.
Chatterton left Nagel to steer in the wheelhouse and walked down the steep white stairs to the rear deck. He called the divers together and asked them to step into the salon for a meeting. One by one, the divers gathered on bunks, on the floor, by the toaster, under the Playboy centerfolds, their hair still slicked with salt water, a few clutching pretzels or cokes. Chatterton addressed the group in his booming, Long Island-tinged baritone.
"This is a huge dive," he said, "but finding it isn't enough. We need to identify it. We identify it, and we rewrite history. Bill and I have made a decision. We're coming back to the wreck on September 21st. It's a private trip. Only you guys are invited. No one else comes. There are a lot of great divers out there, guys who are legends, who would kill to come with us. They aren't coming. If you decide not to attend, your bunk stays empty. But we gotta keep this thing secret. Word gets out that we found a submarine, and we'll have 200 guys crawling all over our asses out here."
Chatterton paused for a moment. No one made a sound. He asked the men to swear an oath of secrecy. Every diver on the boat, he said, had to swear silence about what they had found this day. If others asked what the men had done today, they were to say they dove the Parker. He told them to eliminate the word submarine from their vocabularies. He told them to say nothing to anyone until they identified the wreck.
"This must be unanimous," Chatterton said. "Every one of you guys needs to agree. If even a single guy in this room isn't comfortable keeping this secret, that's cool, that's fine. But then the next trip becomes catch-as-catch-can, an open boat, anyone welcome. So I gotta ask you now, is everyone in?"
Deep wreck charters are not communal events. The divers' presence together on the boat is a matter of transportation, not teamwork. Each devises his own plan, seeks his own artifacts, makes his own discoveries. Deep wreck divers, however friendly, learn to think of themselves as self-contained entities. In dangerous waters, such a mindset enables them to survive. Now Chatterton was proposing that 14 men become a single, silent organism. Agreements like this simply did not occur on dive charters. For a moment there was silence. Some of these men had only just met on this trip. Then, one by one, the divers went around the room and spoke.
"I'm in.
Me too.
I'm not saying shit.
Count me in.
My mouth is shut."
In a minute it was done. Every man had agreed. This was their submarine. This was their submarine alone. The Seeker glided back toward Brielle on a cushion of hope and possibility. Divers passed around Yerga's U-boat book and tried to contain themselves, fashioning responsible rejoinders like, "We know this will take time to research and will likely be complex, but with solid work we should be optimistic about identification." Inside, they were jumping on trampolines and dancing in sandboxes. As evening fell, they allowed themselves to invent scenarios to explain their submarine. And in the heady triumph of the journey home, all theories were credible. Every idea a possibility. Could Hitler be aboard this sub? Isn't there some rumor he tried to escape Germany at the end of the war? Maybe the wreck is filled with Nazi gold. 6 hours later, at about 9 p.m., Nagel eased the boat back into its slip, and the divers gathered their gear. One diver, Steve Feldman, stayed back, waiting for Chatterton to emerge from the wheelhouse. Of the 14 men aboard this boat, Feldman was the newest to the sport, with about 10 years of experience. He had discovered diving later in life, at 34, after a painful divorce. So hopelessly had he fallen in love with scuba that he had virtually willed himself to become an instructor, and of late had been teaching diving classes in Manhattan. Many of the divers on board, including Chatterton, had never seen Feldman before this trip. He dove most often in warm-water resort locations, or for lobsters on Captain Paul Hepler's famous Wednesday bug runs off Long Island. As Chatterton made his way down to the back deck, Feldman stopped him.
"John, I want to thank you," he said. "This trip has been so cool. And it's important. It's really important. I can't wait until we go back. I mean, I'm really excited to be returning. And I just want to thank you and Bill for including me on something like this. This is like a dream come true."
"It is for me too, pal," Chatterton said. "This is the thing you dream about." The Seeker's secret lasted nearly 2 full hours. Around midnight, Kevin Brennan dialed his close friend Richie Kohler, a fellow Brooklynite. At 29, Kohler was already one of the Eastern Seaboard's most accomplished and daring deep-wreck divers. He was also a passionate amateur historian with a keen interest in all things German. To Brennan, it would have been disloyal to keep such exciting news from his friend. Kohler, in fact, would have been invited on the Seeker trip but for a history of bad blood with Chatterton. Kohler had been one of Stevie's boys, and though he had since had an angry falling out with Belinda, his history with Chatterton and Belinda virtually guaranteed that he would not have been welcome on this trip. The phone rang in Kohler's bedroom.
"Richie, man, Richie, wake up. It's Kevin."
"What time is it?"
"Listen, man, wake up. We found something really good."
"What did you find? What time is it?"
"That's the thing, Richie. I can't tell you what we found."
Kohler's wife rolled over and glared. He took the phone into the kitchen.
"Kevin, cut the shit. Just tell me what you found."
"No, man, I took an oath. I promised not to tell. You can't make me tell."
"Look, Kevin, you can't call here at midnight, tell me you found something great, then expect me to go back to sleep. Let's have it."
"I can't, man. Richie, come on, don't bust my balls."
"I'll tell you what. Take a guess. If you guess right, I won't say no."
So Kohler, in his underwear and still bleary-eyed, plopped down at the kitchen table and guessed.
"Is it a passenger liner?"
"No."
"A barge?"
"No."
"The Carew?"
"The Carolina?"
"The Texel?"
"Nope, nope, nope."
The guessing ballet continued for another 5 minutes. Always Brennan's answer was no. Kohler rose and paced the room. His face turned red.
"Kevin, give me a hint, you bastard. You're breaking my shoes here."
Brennan thought it over. Then, in a thick, almost cartoonish Italian accent, he said,
"It's not a my boat. It's a..."
"What?" Kohler asked.
"That's your hint," Brennan said. "Take it or leave it."
"It's not a my boat. It's a..."
"Have you been drinking, Kevin?"
"That's your hint, Richie."
For 5 minutes, Brennan repeated the clue. For 5 minutes, Kohler paced and cursed his friend, conjuring expletives and variations of expletives only another Brooklynite could reassemble. Then it came to him.
"It's a not a my boat. It's a U-boat."
"A U-boat?
You found a U-boat?"
"Shit, yes, Richie, we did."
Kohler sat down.
"A U-boat?
There were no U-boats in New Jersey waters."
"It's got to be the spikefish," Kohler finally exclaimed,
referring to the World War II American submarine sunk in the 1960s for target practice. If anything, you found the spikefish.
No, Richie, I was kneeling in the sand in front of it. I was looking up, and I could hear the music from Das Boot. Da-da-da-da!
You can't tell anyone. This is top, top secret. I'm calling Bill Nagel right now, Kohler said. I gotta be on the next trip.
No, no, don't do that, Richie. You can't say anything.
Kohler finally agreed to keep the secret. Like Brennan, he went to sleep that night rerunning scenes from Das Boot. That same evening, Nagel hit the bottle in celebration of the discovery. With each sip, the notion of keeping such a secret seemed selfish, even criminal. Ice clinking in his glass, he called Danny Crowell, a mate on the Seeker who, because of a business obligation, had been unable to make the trip. He didn't bother with clues.
"We found a U-boat," he slurred. "Don't tell a fucking soul."
The next morning, as John Yerga punched in at the dive shop where he worked, he received a call from Joe, Captain Zero Terzuoli, a friendly dive boat captain. Terzuoli was the store's best customer.
"Yerga, hey, it's Zero. How was your trip?"
"Oh, it wasn't too bad. It was a rock pile, so we moved on and dove the Parker."
"Oh, well, you took your shot," Zero said. "Catch you soon, buddy."
5 minutes later, the phone rang again. Yerga answered.
"This is Zero. I just talked to Ralphie, who talked to Danny Crowell, who says Bill Nagel told him it was a U-boat."
Yerga's stomach pounded. He liked Zero. It sickened him to lie. But he had sworn an oath.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Zero. It was rocks, man. Call Bill."
Yerga hung up and raced to dial Nagel before Zero could do it.
"Bill, this is Yerga. What the hell is going on? Did you open your mouth?"
"That fucking Danny Crowell," Nagel exploded. "I told him not to tell."
The remaining divers seemed better able to keep the secret. A few told family or non-diver friends, while others were unwilling to risk it even with wives. Soon, word of Nagel's indiscretion reached Chatterton. He knew his friend's weakness and was not surprised. He suggested that Nagel make several outlandish claims, to say on Monday that he had discovered a U-boat, on Tuesday that he had found the Corvallis, on Wednesday the Carolina, and so on, until no one believed any bit of it. Nagel mumbled that he would try. Chatterton heard the ice clink. The men would need to stand guard with that much more vigilance to prevent getting jumped on the wreck the next time out. 2 weeks was an agonizing wait for divers so alive with mystery. Landlocked for eternity, many did the next best thing to diving. They hit the books. Most worked independently from their homes or local libraries. They consulted area shipwreck chronicles, U-boat histories, and World War II naval records. Their strategy: find any submarines recorded sunk anywhere near where the mystery wreck lay. 2 U-boats leaped from the pages. In April 1944, Allied forces sank U-550 at a location of 40 degrees 9 minutes north latitude and 69 degrees 44 minutes west longitude. Those numbers sounded distinctly New Jersey to the divers. They rushed to their navigational charts and traced their fingers along the lats and longs until they reached a point about 100 miles north of the mystery wreck's general location. Still in New Jersey waters, but not a great match. Still, no one had ever found U-550. To most of the divers, the 100-mile discrepancy might be explainable. Perhaps U-550's sinking location was recorded imprecisely. Perhaps U-550 had only been wounded by Allied forces and then limped underwater to the mystery wreck site before sinking. Perhaps anything. U-550 was the only submarine recorded sunk in New Jersey waters. She became the diver's odds-on favorite. Close behind was U-521, which had been sunk in June 1943 at a position of approximately 37 degrees 43 minutes north latitude and 73 degrees 16 minutes west longitude. Again, the divers consulted their navigational charts. This location lay in Virginia waters, about 90 miles east of Chincoteague Bay. Though not in New Jersey waters, the site was just 120 miles south of the mystery wreck.
As with U-550, the divers considered such a discrepancy to be explainable. As with U-550, the U-521 remained undiscovered. Divers called each other breathlessly to announce their findings. It is either U-550 or U-521. No doubt about it. Yerga sent a letter to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. He made this request. "I'd like all the information you have on U-boats, please," then gave his name and address. A week later, Yerga received a letter from an archivist. "Mr. Yerga, we have 43 linear feet of floor-to-ceiling shelves of U-boat documents. This does not include drawings, just text. Perhaps you might be interested in visiting here to do your research." For his part, Nagel had done a bit of research into U-550 and U-521. He trembled with excitement as he digested these stories and processed their implications. Both U-boats had been reported sunk relatively close to the mystery wreck site. Neither U-boat had ever been found. To Nagel, this was proof that the submarine they had discovered was either U-550 or U-521. He phoned Chatterton and asked him to drop by the Seeker after work. Around dusk, Chatterton pulled into the Horrible Inn's parking lot. Nagel was on the Seeker's back deck, standing watch over the pile of research papers he had accumulated.
"John, come on board. You gotta see this," Nagel called to him. "Are you ready for some stories?"
For the next hour, Nagel walked Chatterton through the sinkings of U-550 and U-521. With each detail, Chatterton became more convinced that neither U-boat was the mystery sub. When Nagel finished, Chatterton shook his head.
"Bill, no way."
"What do you mean, no way?"
"It's not either of those U-boats."
"The hell you mean? Why not?"
"Bill, look at the reported sinking location for U-550. It's 100 miles from our location. That is a huge distance."
"The Allies must have gotten the location wrong," Nagel interrupted. "It was the heat of battle. Someone made a mistake. A slip of the pen."
"Didn't happen, Bill. You've got 3 destroyers there. They agree on the location. Look at these attack reports. Are you telling me that 3 separate warships made 3 separate but identical mistakes? Are you telling me these destroyers knew how to find Northern Ireland but couldn't accurately record their location in American waters?"
Nagel breathed hard for a minute but said nothing. Chatterton shrugged his shoulders in apology. Nagel's eyes grew angry.
"Well, then, our wreck must be U-521, Nagel said. "If it's not the 550, it's the goddamn 521.
"It's not the 521 either," Chatterton said. "Again, we're talking about a United States Navy ship relatively close to the coast. Are we supposed to believe that the Navy can't tell if they're off Baltimore or Brielle? The Navy can't tell where they are? How can you be 60 miles offshore and not know where you are?"
The veins in Nagel's forehead popped out. "Okay, wise-ass. Which U-boat is it, then?"
"I don't know, Bill, but I'm pretty damn sure it's neither one of those."
A few days later, Chatterton decided to take a trip. Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry was the permanent home of U-505, a type IXC U-boat captured by the Allies off Africa in 1944. The submarine had been kept in pristine condition and was open to the public.
"I want to walk through the submarine and feel it," Chatterton told his wife, Kathy. "I know nothing about U-boats, but I want to go inside, stand in it, and absorb things."
The airlines demanded a fortune to fly midweek with no notice. Chatterton paid it. He would take a day off from work, stay in Chicago for several hours, then fly home.